some of the provocations that for this Indian resistance and attack really on the Spanish, we will never have a complete picture of it, of course, because we weren't on the inside knowing what the Indians were thinking about. But in retrospect, there were many clear signs that the missionaries missed of the Indian discontent. For instance, one of the things they did, and this is, comes out from the mission baptismal records, that a few months before the attack in November of 1775, the missionaries began what amounted to wholesale baptism of the Indians and were bringing them in large groups and simply getting their, either designating a leader or finding out who their leader was and then simply bringing in a little village or group. I think one of the, also there was several instances of punishment of the Indians for things that in their culture were certainly nothing wrong at all, and they simply couldn't understand the Spanish punishment and resented it very much. For instance, some of the Baja California Indians who came from up with the missionaries had married native Indian girls in the San Diego area, and a group of them were participating in some kind of ritual dance, probably the fertility or just before the harvesting of the crops or whatever, and it was part of their whole social religious system. The Spanish objected to the Indian participation in this dance, some kind of ritual that had probably some religious and social significance to the Indians, and they punished the Indians for doing this.
Claire, what actually happened during that attack in 1775?
Well, from the records, evidently what happened is that Indians from many different rancherias, perhaps somewhere between 600 and 1,000 Indians, it's estimated, actually took part in the attack. They came to the mission, which by this time had been removed from the Presidio, and it was on the site of the present mission, which is to say about 6 miles away from the Presidio, farther up Mission Valley. The Indians attacked the structures there, which were not permanent structures. They were probably brush huts, and it was easy to burn them. The few people who were there either ran out, as Father Jaime did, and evidently as he went out, he said to the Indians, "Love God, my children," which was a greeting that came from Mallorca. Father Serra and the other Mallorcans had brought this traditional greeting, "Amor a Dios," love God. Father Jaime came out and said this, and of course it was either not understood or not paid any attention to. And Jaime himself was killed by the Indians, and there were two other Spanish workmen who were killed.
Father Jaime became then the first martyr in California, is that correct?
He's referred to as the first Christian martyr, yes. And he is buried at Mission San Diego. The Indians, however, and again it has been brought out that warfare was really not part of their culture, and so they didn't follow up on this attack by going to the Presidio, which certainly they could have easily overwhelmed, but they did not do so. They retreated and went back to their villages or back to the hills, and that was the end of the attack.
Claire, we have done some discussion so far about the relationship between the Indians and the missionaries, and the question of the treatment of the Indians by the missionaries is a very difficult one to deal with. I'm curious how historians looking back from the 20th century evaluate this period in terms of the treatment of the native people of California.
Well, I'd like to read portions of a couple of articles that have come out just in this last year. They've been printed in the Journal of San Diego History, and each one of these articles deals with this question, and it's very clear that they've done a great deal of research. One of them is written by Robert Heiser, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and he has written an article called Impact of Colonization on the Native Californians. The tragedy of the mission system was that despite the desire of the missionaries to bring a better life to the Indians, they brought with them also many European diseases against which the Indians had no resistance. Heiser says, the primary result of the mission system in human terms was the huge waste of life in the very people whom the system was intended to aid and to guide out of savagery into civilization. And Heiser goes on to say, if we accept the figure of about 300,000 Native Californians living at the moment of first settlement in 1769, probably only about 150,000 were alive in 1834 when the mission system came to an end. The gold rush and American settlement were even more devastating than Spanish colonization. By 1855, that population of 150,000 had been reduced to 50,000, one cause being disease, but, as Heiser says, homicide was the greatest factor in this reduction. Dr. Heiser also comments on the failure of the mission system to produce independent, self-supporting Spanish citizens to convert the Indians into these kind of independent Spanish citizens. And he concludes, I see the mission system as rigid, inflexible, unchanging, and aimed at its own perpetuation. That is probably the main reason for the failure of the missionaries to instill a sense of independence and initiative in the converts. Another article in another issue that came out also earlier this year of the Journal of San Diego History is written by Robert Archibald. And he has studied the records that were kept by the missionaries relating to crime and punishment under the mission system. And he refers also to a lengthy report that was written by Father Lasuen in 1801. Indians, according to these various reports, were punished for a variety of offenses. And, of course, some of them were very serious offenses, theft and assault and murder. But they were also punished for things like neglect of their religious duties, failure to perform work, and they were punished for running away. The most frequent kind of punishment given was whipping, anywhere from 25 to 50 lashes. And occasionally these were laid on with such force that the Indians died as a result of the whipping. Sometimes they were chained, sometimes they were put in stocks, sometimes they were imprisoned. Father Lasuen wrote that as a justification for the punishments, he said, these are people of vicious and ferocious habits, without education, without government, religion, or respect for authority. Well, Robert Archibald concludes that, in his words, despite good intentions, the mission system decimated and destroyed Native people subject to it. This destruction was inexcusable, but not intentional. The missionaries would philosophically have preferred dead Christians to live pagans. It's not fair to remove these men from their place in time and subject them to the standards of the 20th century. The Franciscans, says Archibald, saw themselves as agents for salvation in the next world, not this.
What adds to the complication is the fact that we are so far removed from the missionaries in time, in attitudes, in points of view. Father Francis Guest feels that this period of history must be evaluated by its own standards.
I think we must look at the missionaries in Spanish California or Hispanic California from the standpoint of culture. The culture of the 17th and 18th centuries, especially in Spain and Spanish America, is known as Baroque culture. It was primarily theological, ecclesiastical, and aristocratic. Now, it was succeeded in Europe in the latter half of the 18th century by the culture known as the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was non-Christian, secularized, and bourgeois. Now, our culture today in the United States of America is simply that of the Enlightenment grown to full stature and come to full flower. And it is not really just for Americans of today with our ideas of liberty and freedom, which we got from the Enlightenment, to pass judgment on the missions of Hispanic California from our own point of view, our late 20th century standpoint. The people of the 18th century are to be judged by the standards of the 18th century, not by those of the 20th. And the people of Baroque culture in the 18th century should be judged by the standards of Baroque culture, not by those of the culture of the Enlightenment in its full flower in the late 20th century. The late 20th century American is accustomed to look at life from the standpoint of a pluralistic society in which there are many religions and many creeds and many beliefs. Whereas the Spaniard of the 18th century knew only one creed, one religion, one belief, and that was Catholicism. The Enlightenment had made a very limited progress in New Spain at that time.
Father Francis Guest, archivist and librarian at the Santa Barbara Mission Archive Library. Just what did the Spaniards hope to accomplish in their settlements in the New World? What was their ultimate plan for the Indians, and did it succeed? Again, Dr. Iris Engstrand of the University of San Diego.
Well, the ideal was that in 10 years, in fact, the 10-year limitation was even in the laws of the Indies, that the Indians would be fully trained to be functioning Spanish citizens. They would receive a certain tract of land, and then they would be released from the mission environment. Actually, this was not done. It didn't seem to work. And, of course, there are contrary opinions about this. The priests insisted that the Indians were not ready in this short time to really function on an individual basis. Some of the civilians, the people who wanted the land, said, no, the priests are just not training them well enough. They want to keep their little empire, and they don't want this land to be divided up. Now, from the Indian point of view, which you probably tried to understand, is that the Indians may never have been ready to undertake what the Spanish wanted them to do because of their cultural traditions. I think this is an example of where one culture is trying to implant its values, its traditions, its whole way of life onto another culture, which is really functioning in a very different manner. And the Indians were getting along well. They didn't have any particular problems in California. The food supply was fairly abundant. And so the Spanish come and they want to, you know, just change the system totally. And I think that their successes were probably with children who were born in the missions and grew up there, but they never, I would say they never really succeeded in changing the Indians' motivations or their psychological makeup, and that's where they just had to fail.
Dr. Iris Engstrand, professor of history at the University of San Diego. And so the mission system, as an agent of Spanish colonization on the frontier, did not fulfill its goals, but the missions, through the efforts of Father Serra to a great extent, did provide the basis for the future settlement of New Spain and for the development of Hispanic culture in what is now the American Southwest. In fact, the missions have left a great deal to us all, and this is probably a prime reason why every year many San Diegans participate in an event that commemorates not only the founding of the San Diego Mission by Father Serra, but many other facets of our history as well. The annual Trek to the Cross takes place at Presidio Hill, the site where Father Serra said the first Mass on July 16th of 1769. And so, each year, July 16th is the date for this event. Bill Parker is its organizer, and he's been involved with the Trek to the Cross since the 1940s.
Well, it's really a procession which was on the 16th of July originally, 1769. Father Serra and his group, Portola, the military escort governor of the Padres that came up here, had departed to find Monterey. He couldn't find it. He went clear by it and didn't recognize it from the description on the sea side of the thing and came back here. But he left on the 14th of July. And on the 16th, they moved up to Presidio Hill from a flat down about where the present church is now. They moved up from a little campment there to the glen up there. They call it the Padre Glen. There's a statue of a Franciscan Padre in there. He's a little bit too human style to have been Father Serra, but then he does for an exemplification of what Father Serra stood for, at least. And we march up there and have a mass, usually by the Padre here of the Immaculate Conception Parish, and that parish, as well as the whole community, participate in it. The occasion seems to me to warrant the people of all San Diego participation. I know that everybody's got their own little pet project, but the beginning of San Diego is here. And everybody can, without betraying their own area, participate in the very beginning of San Diego or its reenactment.
Bill Parker, organizer for the annual Trek to the Cross. Probably the greatest reminder to us all of Father Serra and the mission period in San Diego is the Mission San Diego de Alcalá, located about 6 miles east of the Presidio in Mission Valley. Monsignor I. Brent Egan is the pastor of the Mission Basilica of San Diego. He tells of the mission's history after the earliest times on Presidio Hill.
In 1774, Father Jaime, who had succeeded Father Serra as pastor here, moved from the Presidio to the present location in Mission Valley, about 6 miles up the river.
Mm-hmm. What were the principal reasons for the move?
Well, first of all, the Spanish soldiers were consorting with some of the Indian maidens, some of the young women that Father Jaime hoped to convert and to bring into Christianity, and the pernicious influence and example of the soldiers was detrimental to their conversion. There was also a need for a water supply, and the San Diego River still runs by the present mission. In fact, during the past winter, we had a flooded area there. There was also a need for better farmlands, and the farmlands around the mission have been noted for many years as very fruitful. The mission really reached its heyday about 1820, and unfortunately about this time then the Spanish left due to the pressure from Mexico, and the mission was secularized. All of the land was sold, and in fact the mission compound was purchased by the Arguello family in San Diego, and they used the mission tiles for buildings in Old Town and other areas that were beginning to develop at that time. the United States Cavalry came to San Diego in the 1850s, and they occupied the mission grounds. The mission church was used as a stable on the ground floor, and the second floor was used as a barracks. This was a time of fighting in the San Pasqual Valley and so forth, and so the mission became the presidio for the U.S. Cavalry during that period. And then in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln restored the mission and 22 acres surrounding the mission to the church. It was a very gradual transition from the ruins that the ravages of time and the presence of the military had left the church. And it really was not completely restored until 1931.
Monsignor I. Brent Egan, the San Diego Mission is not only an historic site, it's also an active parish with a wide range of activities for parishioners. There are also concerts and sites of interest to tourists, such as the architecture of the buildings, the gardens, and a museum and visitor center. Visitors can also view archaeological digs, which have been uncovering information about the earlier history of the site of today's mission. And despite the obvious marks of recent times, there's still a strong sense of San Diego's past at the mission.
Was the location, we believe, of the first very small brush and reed structure that Father Serra built after leaving the Presidio of San Diego to come up Mission Valley. So we're looking east and we're looking out over the river valley, and although there's been a great deal of construction and there are wrecking yards today in the area, the habitat is not unlike that of 210 years ago.
Dr. Raymond Brandis is a professor of history at the University of San Diego. He's a man who's been active in the archaeological work at the San Diego Mission. The Mission is a place where San Diegans can see our earlier history and learn about the people who, like Father Junipero Serra, played important roles in the Spanish settlement of this area.
I think that sometimes we tend to underestimate the capabilities of the priests who served in the California missions. They were men of indomitable courage and character. And we tend to think of the priests as having one mission, and that was to Christianize the native inhabitants, to make them, first of all, natives of Spain. We tend to think that that was their role in life. It was, and it was a big part of their life. But these were all men who not only had the theological and the academic training in schools or seminaries in the old world and in Mexico, but they also spent a considerable amount of time working in factories to learn how to make pottery, in trade schools, working at agriculture so that they, for example, so that they could bring those concepts to the people that they were going to missionize throughout the world. And the idea was to make life easier.
And Dr. Brandis sees the mission site of today as one of great historical importance, not only to San Diegans, but to the history of the development of the United States as a whole.
Great things will happen at this site because of its significance to the Christian world. It marks the birthplace of Christian heritage in the New World, at least in our part of the New World. It marks the location where the first priest was martyred in our part of the world, Father Luis Jaime. And it marks the place where one of the great, really the architect of the California missions began, Father Fermin Las Swain, began his work here. And it marks the place where Father Serra began his work. And someday I predict Father Serra will become a saint.
Dr. Raymond Brandis, professor of history at the University of San Diego. The process of canonization that he referred to is naturally one not taken lightly by the Catholic Church. It's a long and careful process. Since the time of Serra, there's been a tradition of pious remembrance of Serra as a holy man, beginning with the biography by his former student, Father Palou. In this century, there has been an increase in interest in sainthood for Serra. The first formal step was taken by the late Father Maynard Geiger, who gathered all documentation relevant to canonization. This documentation, now carefully arranged and indexed, is also invaluable to the further study of Sarah's life. There are many other steps in the process that remain, but there are many who believe that someday Father Sarah will be declared a saint. Of course, there are many individuals who played important roles in the development of San Diego during the mission period. Claire, I'd like to ask you now, why is it that we single out Father Sarah? In what ways was Father Sarah the key figure in this particular part of our history?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. Of course, he founded the first mission here in San Diego, and it's not just a religious site. Of course, it's the beginning of European civilization here in this area. He founded the first 9 missions along the coast of California between San Diego and San Francisco, and so he personally then made a very lasting impact. The mission buildings are still visible today, whereas the presidios, the Spanish military establishments, have all crumbled into ruin. And the physical survival of the mission buildings symbolizes the spiritual and cultural significance of the mission system. The missions made a more enduring impact on California than the military institutions did. Of course, neither one would have been possible without the other. The presidios and the military detachments at each mission provided protection for the missions against Indian attacks, and the missions in turn provided food and clothing for the soldiers. The enduring significance of Father Sarah and the mission system is that they brought what we think of as civilization and culture in European terms here to California. That is, they taught the Indians how to plant and harvest diversified crops, how to raise and manage domesticated animals, cows and horses, sheep, goats and pigs. All of these, you know, were brought to California by the Spaniards. There were no domesticated animals. There were no horses, no sheep, no pigs. The missionaries taught the Indians how to build structures for their houses and storage areas, barns and so on, as well as churches, taught them how to build dams and aqueducts for agricultural irrigation. They taught them how to make clothing and tools and utensils. Father Sarah and his Franciscan brothers brought to the Indians some knowledge of European arts and crafts, some appreciation of European art and literature and music and science. Although conversion to Christianity was certainly an important reason for the existence of the mission system, it was only part of its total influence on the Indians' lifestyle. The mission system, although it failed in terms of its original objectives, that is, of converting the Indians to Spanish colonists who would farm and raise cattle and become Spanish citizens. Although it failed in those terms, it certainly left enduring influences on the land and the people of San Diego and, of course, of California as a whole. The lands that were first developed for crops or pasturage during the mission era continued in similar use for a century or more before being transformed into the cities or subdivisions of today. El Cajon, for example, and Tierra Santa, these were parts of the Mission San Diego lands originally. Mission architecture has certainly continued to exercise an influence on building design. The variety and richness of our culture is in part the reflection of Spanish customs and costumes, foods and festivals, music, and certainly language. Every day we all pay tribute to the Spanish influence in our use of place names such as San Diego.
Dr. Claire Crane, San Diego historian and chief historical consultant for this series of programs on San Diego history. The missions continued until they were secularized in 1833. Meanwhile, Mexico achieved independence from Spain, and the town of San Diego became a part of Mexico. Great changes were signaled by the increasing immigration from the United States. That began with traders from the East Coast seeking the hide and tallow trade. One of these traders was Captain Henry Delano Fitch, who became the first American to settle in San Diego and become a Mexican citizen, and who later drew the map which determined the legal boundaries of the city. Captain Fitch is the subject of next week's program. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego. The programs are heard each week at 12:30 Tuesday afternoon and 8 o'clock Wednesday night. A resource packet is available with these programs. If you'd like one, send $2 to KPBS-FM, San Diego 92182, and ask for the San Diego History Resource Packet. We also welcome your comments on this series. The address again is KPBS-FM, San Diego 92182. I'm Peter Hamlin, series producer, thanking you for joining us. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a production of public radio station KPBS-FM and is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.